Menachem Chaver, Binyamin Hammer here at National Council of Young Israel. We're very happy to welcome Rebbe for conference call number 70. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. Number one, a group of guys has created a gambling pool in order to incentivize themselves to be koveitim. They each agree to learn a set amount of hours each day, and anyone who doesn't meet the learning quota by the end of the week needs to give $10 to the guy who met the quota. If no one met the learning quota for the week, then no money is exchanged. Is this a problem of asmachta? Asmachta is a very complex halachic topic. Whether it applies in this case or doesn't apply in this case is a very long discussion, and I think it's beside the point. The main point over here is this is a very bad idea because the word gambling pool. Gambling pool, the very term, should send a shudder on anybody's spine. Unfortunately, too many people, even individuals who keep Shabbos, who are koveitim, fall into addictions of gambling. And there are all kinds of gambling addictions. They're all terrible, some worse than others. They can be destructive. They can destroy a person's life, destroy his family life, destroy his children, destroy his marriage. It seems to me that the whole concept of gambling is terrible and should be avoided at all costs. Just coming off Hanukkah, some people have a game of dreidel. That is true. So if you want to do dreidel, someone should put a few pennies in the pot. They should spin the dreidel around and all the pennies go back to the pot at the end. All kinds of gambling, in my opinion, should be avoided at all costs. Not so much because of asmachta. There are, again, complexities because of the fear that could lead to an addiction. Two, a rabbi recently told me that if someone accidentally started eating ice cream, dairy, for dessert after eating a meat meal and realizes in the middle, he can finish the ice cream. I was surprised to hear this. Is this accurate? Is there a makor for this? The answer is it's absolutely wrong. The makor is as follows. There's a discussion if somebody was fleishik and he was eating ice, wanted to eat dessert ice cream. He makes a shahak on the abidvaro and he says, whoops, I can't eat this. I am fleishik. Some poskim say you can take a mashu of the ice cream in order to avoid a bracha levatola. From that psak, which is disputed, but that is a legitimate source, probably came to this misunderstanding to allow them to finish the ice cream, which is absolutely not true. Three, A, can I attend a wedding, quote unquote, where two women are marrying each other? She is a coworker. B, does it make a difference if this person is my superior and may affect my job / pronunciability? C, would it make any difference if it were two men or two women? D, this is a kosher candidate event. Is there a hazard to attend any part of the reception? Very sad question. Unfortunately, the existence of the question is sad. Wasn't that long ago where such a question would never be asked. Discussing this question is very difficult because of the various sensitivities involved. If you don't toe the party line of some individuals, you're accused of all kinds of bigotry and worse. I'm speaking from the perspective of halacha. From the perspective of halacha, it's absolutely no way that one can attend such an event. The word wedding is properly in quotation marks. You do not recognize a wedding, quote unquote, of two women or of two men. And I'm not discussing here the prohibition, because C is correct. When it comes to the prohibition, there was a distinction between two men and two women. Two men is a much more serious violation, a homosexual act of two men, as opposed to what we'll call a homosexual act of two women. One is a much more serious violation than the other, although both are on a level of Isur Daraisa, but not all Isurim Daraisa are of if even status. Some could be a Lo Sase of Masi Eretz Mitzrayim, and some could be an Isur Skila. So the Isur is not the same level. I can see that as question C implies. But it seems to me that we're not discussing the level of prohibitions. There are many prohibitions in the world. many prohibitions. There are many prohibitions of skila. Shabbos is also nisa of skila. And of course, we are totally against anyone who's machal Shabbos. But this idea of, quote, weddings between two men and two women is a complete violation of the basic family unit of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, it undermines the sustainability of the Klal even more so than the Chilul Shabbos. We know the Chafetz Chaim said famously the Chilul Shabbos, that's the Os, the example of the store when the sign comes down. And we know that. But this is even worse, because this completely undermines any proper understanding of what marriage is, or what family unit is. And therefore, it seems to me that one cannot attend. The fact that it's kosher food indicated to me that they were talking about a coworker who was Jewish. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been a kosher food. Now, these prohibitions apply even to non-Jews, and one cannot go there either. But that's being placed by a Jewish person is so much more severe in our eyes, because it's undermining, as I said, the whole essence of what a Jewish home is. And therefore, in my event, my opinion, you cannot attend any part of the reception. And sad to say, it does not matter if the person is your superior and can affect your job or parnassa ability. It should not. It's probably against the law if it does. But unfortunately, not everyone is protected as they should be by the law. Religious scruples are certainly permissible. And this is certainly a case where there are appropriate religious scruples to stay away from such events, quote-unquote, weddings. At the same time, such a worker who is in fears the parnassa and job ability should take whatever steps are necessary to see to it that the job / parnassa will in fact be secure, because otherwise you lose a parnassa, that's no good. But to attend a wedding of two women, it seems to me, is absolutely prohibited. I can't find any way in which this can be done. And I say it with great pain, because it's such a difficult problem which is becoming more prevalent. I know when in my community where I live, there was such a quote-unquote wedding took place of two men. And individuals who I thought would know better attended, and they were even dancing. And it's just a travesty. It's a travesty and a tragedy at the same time. Question 4. What bracha, if any, is recited upon having a baby boy, B, a baby girl, C, twins, a boy and a girl, D, at what point should the bracha brachos be recited? A baby boy, it's quoted in the Gemara in the Shulchan Aruch, hatov v'hametiv. A baby girl, nothing is found. The Mishnah Berurah paskens, you can say a bracha of shehechiyonu, because you're seeing someone for the first time. It's a kal v'chomer for the first time ever. There are some authorities who maintain that nowadays a person can make a tov v'hametiv on a baby girl as well. And their thinking is as follows. In the olden days, for various economic and other reasons, everybody wanted to have a boy. Women wanted to have boys. Men wanted to have boys. Terem tovo cheva lovim lita zocher, the Navi expresses himself. But boys were considered to be a greater bracha, and therefore hatov v'hametiv was recited, and girls, not so much. My Rebbe of Soloveitchik once told a story. Kavu gets a beis medrash, gets a mother, it's a baby, it's a girl, they gave him pech. You know, these are Europeanisms, which now don't ring anymore. And therefore, if someone decided to make hatov v'hametiv on a baby girl, one could not be overly critical, because at least where I come from, it's wonderful news, the same as a baby boy. If someone wants to make a shechayon like the Mishnah Berurah, it's also fine. Make nothing has a place too. Twins, a boy and a girl, one bracha should be made. Hatov hametiv, hatov hametiv includes within it shechayonu. And that's what should be done. At what point should the bracha be made? Immediately. And in the olden days, you have a besura tova, so you make a bracha. In the olden days, the man was nowhere near the delivery room. Either he was downstairs or he got as far as the labor room. But in the last 30, 40 years or so, when things have changed, the man is often in the delivery room. It's to be careful what he looks at when he's in the living room, but okay, he's usually there these days. And as soon as the great news comes out, thank God, a baby boy, a baby girl, the truth is it's not much of a basura for many people these days to know the gender in advance. So that's another interesting question. In any event, we have a right to follow the traditional brachas. As soon as the husband is told the wonderful news, he should ask his wife to make sure she's okay and ready to listen to a bracha. He should take the bracha and she should answer amen. And this way they're both yotzi with this important bracha. Question 5. Is it permissible to review shul security footage from Shabbos? The answer is yes. There's nothing wrong with doing something on Sunday. A possible question here is, if the person knows in advance that they're going to review the shul security footage on Shabbos, may walk in front of the camera on Shabbos. That, I think, is a better question. I think the answer to that question is also yes, because the shul security footage is not being scrutinized and reviewed because of me, because of the mispalim, looking for ganavim. So as far as the fact that the mispalim finds himself on the screen may actually be only in cyberspace, which is a preferred method if it's only going into a disk. That's preferred. It's always better to do it that way. There should be no active screen on Shabbos. But even if it's an active screen on Shabbos, which is a possibility of some Issa de Rabbanon, maybe, the subsequation of Lo Nichle by the Rabbanon, which the post can say is mutter, certainly in a situation of need. And since Pittsburgh, everyone's more interested in security. And I believe that given these circumstances, having a security camera, even on Shabbos, is permissible. Again, I prefer that there be only a disc and not an actual screen showing it on Shabbos, even if there is one during the week. And in this case, permissible to review the security footage after Shabbos. 6. On Shabbos, is one allowed to squeeze lemons into water to make lemonade? And one squeeze it onto ice cubes? Can one squeeze a fruit on crushed ice? Is that considered a mashkel toch ochel? Well, squeezing lemons into water to make lemonade is a big shaila, very big machlekes. According to one opinion in the Shulchan Aruch, you can squeeze lemons any way you want. The sif in the Shulchan Aruch on Simon Shin Chaf, mutter lischot lemons. That's how it's spelled, lemons. That was in the olden days. Today, if you look at the Mishnah Berurah of Cotton, Chav Beis, nowadays where we squeeze lemons by the thousands to fill up barrels of lemonade to make punch, he says, it's not so simple that it's mutter as it was in the olden days. And therefore, to squeeze lemon stam is a problem. To squeeze lemons into water to make lemonade is also a problem. And yes, even into ice cubes or crushed ice is also a problem. Because it seems to me that ice and ice cubes is not considered a machel, considered a mashke. It's meant to melt into water, and that's what's going to happen momentarily. So therefore, I do not believe they have to exist, so this should not be done. 7. May one pour a warm beverage onto ice cubes already in an empty cup, or must one put the beverage in first and then add the ice cubes? B. May one stir the ice cubes in the beverage with a spoon? Here too, it's a complicated shaila. According to the Ramah, there's a concept called nolad. If something melts, it could be a muktzah problem. And therefore, it's recommended that you put the beverage in first and then add the ice cubes. And we paskin, there's no problem of muktzah because the nolad is bottled from the very beginning. And therefore, it should be done in that fashion. If it's difficult, cannot be done for that reason, for whatever reason, then it's permissible to pour the beverage onto the ice cubes if one does it immediately. In other words, you don't let anything melt. You put the ice cubes in a cup, and right away, you put the liquid on top of the ice cubes, and nothing melts in between. And if nothing melts in between, it's not a halachic problem. As far as stirring, well, even if one actually, we should say, is merasek, that's the lashon of the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, which means crushes. If you crush ice, it's a problem. If you crush ice, which is within a beverage, it's a lesser problem. Some say it's mutter, some say it's usr. It's a whole discussion. That's it, crushing. Stirring, in a certain sense, is akin to crushing. It makes things melt earlier than they would otherwise. And therefore, ideally, we should avoid crushing and even stirring. In the Piskei Tshuvos, in footnote 156, in Siman Shin Chaf, he allows it, the Tzorach Miyuchad. Obviously, that's a question of definition. 8. On a fast day, may one, A, take a shower, B, get a haircut, C, when one wakes up in the morning, may one, 1, wash his mouth out with water, 2, brush his teeth with toothpaste, C, use mouthwash or Listerine strips. Okay. Taking a shower, the Mefurash of Din in the Shulchan Aruch, that's Mutter. Siman Tov, Kuf Nun, Sif Beis. The Mishnah Berurah of Kohen Vav, however, says, Baal Nefesh Yachmir. Shaar Tzion Oscheskel goes as far as to say that Noagu came. I'm not sure this is true in our time. Remember, in the olden days, they didn't have running hot water. People bathed infrequently. In general, in the community, but there was almost no bathing. The Jews were the healthiest. That's why we avoided most of the Black Death, and we were accused of poisoning the wells, because we wash ourselves before Shabbos, as the halacha requires. In the outside world, it was even less of that. And therefore, even in our world, people didn't shower daily, and therefore, why should you take a shower on a fast day? So it was a custom yesteryear. But today, most Americans shower daily. And I don't think there's any minute not to take a shower on a fast day. Medina, it's certainly mutter, mefurash din in the Shulchan Aruch. So my answer is, may one take a shower? The answer is yes. A little bit further than that, we read in B, get a haircut. Once again, why not? The Torah Evan writes in Masechta Rosh Hashanah Yud Ches Amud Beis, Lo Matzinu Isa BePoskim. What's the problem? Should be Hetagama. Now, there's a Gemara. There's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Yud Ches Amud Beis that Rabbi Yoshua was unhappy that it would go to Tainas and Chanukah. And to demonstrate his unhappiness, he took a haircut. So the Torah Evan asked the Kasha, anyone can take a haircut. Any legitimate time to see if you can take a haircut? That's his question. One might argue that maybe for Balei Nefesh it's a problem, as we saw the Mishnah Berurah quoted with respect to washing. Rabbi Yeshua was undoubtedly a Balei Nefesh. Maybe for him, the fact that he took a haircut showed his displeasure with their setting a time to see for Hanukkah. But again, we're not in such a high level of Balei Nefesh, and therefore it's the short answer is that it's mutter. C, wash your mouth out with water. This is discussed not in Siman Tov Kuf Nun, which is Hilchos Tanis Tzibur, but a little later on in Tov Kuf Samach Zayin Siv Gimel. Shulchan Aruch writes, Lo kosher. It's not kosher to do such a thing. Not kosher. Doesn't say it's an absolute prohibition. Not a good thing to do. It's not a kosher thing to do. The Mishnah Berurah writes there in Sivkot Yud Aleph, that is Matir B'Mokom Tzar. B'mokom tsar. Now, how you define tsar is a little bit difficult. And not only that, but mokom tsar is matir on a regular fast day. On Tisha B'Av, he requires tsar godol. Yom Kippur, total iser. Interesting. Interesting. Why? The Easter Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, even Easter of Rechitza. So even if a person washes out his mouth and spits everything out, there's nothing that is being ingested, there's a Rechitza problem. That's quite a remarkable twist. We're talking about eating and drinking, and they're talking there about washing. It's interesting, from the perspective of eating and drinking, there may be certain leniencies. Again, in my view, the washing your mouth out with water and brushing your teeth with toothpaste is the same thing. In both cases, it should not be done. Mouthwash is the same thing. It should not be done. But mokom tsar, it's mutter if you bend over, and it's make sure you spit everything out. Strips are more strict from the perspective of ingesting, because you put a strip on your mouth, the Listerine strip, you know that it's going to be ingested. X amount of minutes later, the strip disappears. Where'd it go? We know where it went. It went down the tube into your body. So strips are much more serious than the others. The others, you can spit out everything, and you can't do that with respect to strips. It's interesting, from the perspective of washing, of course, strips are more lenient. Strips, it's nothing liquid there. It's not considered to be washing. So therefore, there are those who may want to say on Yom Kippur, strips are okay because they're not washing. In my opinion, strips should be avoided not only on Yom Kippur, not only on Tisha B'Av, but on any fast day. And is there that much tzar? See, that much tzar, you know, you can survive. You worry about COVID abrius, a bad breath. Most people, if they brush their teeth the night before carefully, and it won't be such a big problem. But again, if it's Makom Tzar Gadol, or it's more about Kavod Abrius, there's room for leniencies on these on the other fast days. One could say that Listerine, that mouthwash or toothpaste is even better than water, because water is totally drinkable, of course, but no one wants to drink mouthwash or toothpaste water. So that may be a little bit better. Now, it's true that we are makel b'makom choli. The poskim say in Siman Tov Resh Yud Beis, if hey, Mishnah Berurah Tesvav, that chatzi shir, which is something which is ein aroah l'achila, is mut even l'chatchila b'makom choli. That's what we with respect to pills. So perhaps some rabbis think it applies to Listerine strips as well. So chatzi shir is not edible. But it seems to me that's only mat b'makom refuah. The tzar is not that great. Does not rise to that level. Kaini really. 9. Do the extra buttons on the bottom of a button-down shirt cause a problem if there is no eruv? These are known in Hebrew as kafturei reserva, reserve buttons. In the Piskei Tshuvos, Simon Shin Aleph, footnote 244, quotes from Shlomo Zalman, Rabbi Avadja, were mekel, and the Deborah Tzina and Ben Tzion Abba Shul are machmir. And he has an interesting compromise. If it's a fancy button, it's a problem. If it's a standard button, which is most of the case, it's considered to be bottled to the beggar and it's permissible. That's what I think as well. So therefore, the ones may be lenient. No need to go quickly to all your shirts and jackets and coats and rip off the reserve buttons. There's room, ample room to be makel for regular buttons. 10. If there was a big storm Friday afternoon after the Erev had been checked on Friday morning, should the tzibur be recommended not to rely on the Erev for that Shabbos? Obviously, it depends on so many things. Depends on the Erev. Some Erevin are relying on hundreds of strings. One goes down, you have a problem. Other Erevs relying on other things, fences and buildings and other types of mechitzas which don't fall down. Only a smaller number of strings. That's one consideration. The second consideration is, how big is the storm? Do you hear that power lines are going down? You know, some Erev in where there are a lot of trees, and trees, if the trees knock down a power line, Kavachoma, they can knock down an Erev line. Other neighborhoods have their wires going between telephone poles, or even more likely between light poles where there are no trees at all in that part of the community. So every case has to be measured separately. And in recent storms, there were originally saying that it's Becheska that was up, and the last minute said it was down. So you have to try to have someone check it later in the afternoon if possible, and hopefully it'll stay up. 11. What's the halacha / minig of tearing kriya when visiting the coastal after 30 days? A. Is there any substitute action other than tearing kriya? B. There are ads for perforated shirts that would make tearing kriya easier and more becomedic. Is this type of garment considered tearing kriya? Can it be used for avelin? C. Can you purposely go on Shabbos or Chol HaMoed so that you avoid tearing kriya? So first of all, it seems to be a halacha. It's din in the Gemara, it's din in the Shulchan Aruch. It is true that many Israelis are not makbid on this. Some are makbid to go to the coast every Rosh Chodesh to make sure they don't have this problem, and others are mekel. And they're always around. They always could go. There are some poskim say. But for American tourists who come only once in a while it's hard to be makel on this shaila. It sounds like it's a halacha, not just a minig. And I'm not happy with perforated shirts. It sounds like it's a bogus kind of a kriya. The kriya has to be on a regular shirt, not a perforated shirt. And therefore, it shouldn't be used for going to the coastal and kavachom, not for avelim, where it's certainly a din. And yes, you may go on Shabbos to Chol HaMoed to avoid carrying kriya. There's no mitzvah to take kriya. If you were there on Shabbos Chol HaMoed, we pass on the halacha. If you go on Shabbos Chol HaMoed, you're part, even if you go again afterwards. Not everyone agrees to that either, but that's a psak la halacha. 12. How should I advise those coming to shul Friday night for dinner in regards to lighting candles if by the time they get home after dinner the candles will be out? How about guests sleeping at their guests, means at their hosts, I guess, but eating dinner in shul? Does it matter if it's deemed unsafe to light on the tables at dinner, but rather people will light in the shul lobby? Before anything, safety first. Chamira sakanta v'yisura. Unfortunately, as some of you may know, last week on Hanukkah, a house in a frum community in northern New Jersey burned to the ground. A couple lit near Hanukkah and went out to eat by the parents. The police came to tell them that the house had burned down because the Hanukkah Neros caught on fire. No one was there. The whole house burned down. Some of you may have seen a fascinating security footage review, going back to our earlier question, of a family that lit many Neros, a beautiful Neros near a window, and the security camera in the room is capturing the beautiful sight, and all of a sudden you see that one of the menorahs, either something melted or something spilled over or something caught fire, and your heart is in your mouth, as you see gradually the oil coming down and the fire is getting to the floor and it catches fire. All of a sudden there's a big fire, and then Baruch Hashem, the smoke alarm goes off. The balabos runs down the stairs, first blows and it gets the fire extinguisher and puts out the fire. And the Musa Haskell is that every home should have a smoke alarm and a fire extinguisher because these things are dangerous. So therefore, it seems to me, Chamira Sakanta, we're worried here about Hilchos Neros Shabbos, I'm worried about Sakonas Nefoshos. I can tell you a story of someone close to me. They lit many, many candles for every descendant, and they went for a nap, and thank God they got out alive. It caught fire, and they got out alive. The house was burned to the ground. That's Shabbos candles, multiple Shabbos candles. Frankly, I'm happy that my wife, following her mother's minig, lights a total of 2 candles every Shabbos. It's simply safer. Those who have light for one member of the family, they have to be more careful. Leaving the house with candles going is a dangerous proposition. It should be avoided if it's at all possible. And the way to do that is simply to eat at home. I wish the couple that decided to eat out Friday night would have decided to eat out on Shabbos lunch instead and eat at home Friday night, and this tragedy wouldn't have taken place. Thank God everyone is safe, I'm told. Over and above that, if in fact the candles go out before the people come home from the dinner and shul, aside from any chance they took, quote-unquote, on safety, it's probably a bracha levatala. They're not having any hanoah from the neiros. So to solve both problems, the same solution to both problems is you rely on the electric lights. Most poskim say electric lights are kosher for Ner Shabbos. In my opinion, and everyone agrees with me, all electric lights are kosher for Ner Shabbos. It could be the incandescent, the fluorescent, a halogen, an LED, doesn't matter. On Shabbos, it's because of Shalom Bayis, it has to be light. As opposed to Hanukkah, where most poskim think that it has to be dafka, a wick, and a fire. In any event, that's what should be done. The problem is, and how do you do that? After Plag HaMincha, which in the winter is about an hour before the sunset, you flip the lights off and flip them on again. You must do that. The fact that they were on for the morning doesn't help. You flip them off and flip them on. The truth is this activity should be done all the time. Even if a person is home for Shabbos, you should flip the lights off and on before the Balas HaBayis lights the Ner Shabbos for a simple reason. Some poskim say, if the light is on from before, from the morning, Shraga B'tira Mayahani, that the candles add nothing because there's many, many more watts from the electric lights than there are from the candle. So it could also be a shalav of a bracha levatala. We are making b'shas atzchak on the fact that it adds to the ambience, and therefore even though there's more light from the electricity than there is from the candles, would not be a bracha levatala. But not everyone agrees to that. And therefore there's a simple solution on a weekly basis to flip them off and on. And then even if the husband does that, that's what I do. On the way out of the shul, I flip the lights off and on. If my wife remembers, she does it again. So she should have that part of the mitzvah as well. But in any event, when she lights in there Shabbos afterwards, it includes the electric light, so there's no shalav bracha levatala, and it enhances the mitzvah of Neiros Shabbos and Onik Shabbos. This is what should be done every week. In a week such as this, in which the Baal HaSabayis wants to light the Neiros Shabbos in the shul, she can do the same thing, flip the lights off and on, and have in mind not to be in Kabbal Shabbos yet. She can drive even to shul. When she gets to shul, she should light the Neiros Shabbos. She can even make a bracha there if she's lighting in the dining room, ideally on her own table, or at least on a table not too far from where she is. You can see the candles, which add to the ambience somewhat. Better on her own table if they'll allow it. And she should have in mind that this bracha goes on the electric lights in the house as well. Many poskim say that you're not permitted to light where you eat, only where you sleep. In other words, if you're eating, especially eating in a public place like a shul, but even if you're eating in a private place, someone else's house, it's the same as Ner Chanukah. The poskim say Ner Chanukah, if I go to eat supper in someone's house, I can't light. They have to go back to where I sleep. The simple pshat is that Ner Shabbos should be the same as Ner Chanukah. The simple pshat in the Gemara is that way, and the Rishonim. Yes, I'm aware that some poskim say that Ner Shabbos is different because it's more tied to the Achila, and you may light the Mokam Achila, but not everyone agrees, especially if I understand over here the shul lobby. The shul lobby is no way to lighten the shul lobby. No one eats in the shul. They're eating in the dining room, the social, not in the shul lobby. Now you go to hotels these days, they give you a special Hadlokas Neiros room. I call it a Bracha Levatola room, or the Towering Inferno. You know, there are 1,000 lights, the candles. You can't even walk into the room. It's so hot. There's no one doing anything there. That's a terrible thing to do. I wouldn't recommend that at all. In other words, if there's a couple in a hotel, I tell the woman she'll use the electric lights, either a night light, and they have the new night lights that you can cover later on, they turn around, or a hall light if you're in someone else's house and you don't want a light in your room at all, or even a bathroom light. Those are all ways to fulfill the mitzvah of Hadlokas HaNeiros, and not in the quote-unquote Towering Inferno. If they let you light in the shul, in the dining room, then I would say it's kedai to do both, because the women like to light Ner Shabbos. They're not happy with the psak I'm giving, that if they're giving you only the Towering Inferno, you shouldn't light there. But if they let you light in the dining room, ideally at your own table, or otherwise at a side where you can see, add somewhat to the ambience, then you can make a bracha there. But having in mind the candles where you're sleeping in your own home as well. 13. Can one go on vacation to a destination where there will not be a minyan? Ideally, we should approach it that with a minyan. The post can say there's a need to miss minyan. You may miss minyan. It's not an absolute chiyuv. And is there a need to go on vacation? That's a difficult question to answer. Is there a need to go on a vacation with doctor in a place where there is no minyan? That's even a more difficult question. There are plenty of vacation sites which advertise minyanim. So I'm not running to go to such a place where there is no minyan, even though it may have better slopes or better pools or whatever people are going for vacation for. I mean, there's a balance. There are other vacation sites which have minyanim, which a person should try very hard to do and measure the idea of need very carefully. A, you may be able to stay home. People have survived without vacations. And two, if you want to take a vacation, there are many options where there are minyanim. But if there's a shas atzchak, whatever reason, then you may do so even if you miss minyan. Finally, 14. Is it proper for a community to standardize how much people spend on simchas, wedding, bar mitzvah, and bris, and tell people they cannot spend over a certain amount? Oh, is that proper? That's tremendously proper. It's ideal. And in olden days, there were takonas, strictly enforced, limiting the amount of expenditures for these particular simchas. And I wish we could have what we call the Chadesh Shemeinu Kekedem and return to those days. I'm told that in certain Hasidic groups, they still enforce these rules. I was told that the early Gera Rebbe, when he instituted these rules, and some Chassid came to say, but Rebbe, you don't understand, I have business associates, I have this, I have more people. He said, I have no problem, just find yourself a different Rebbe. He would not give in to these Gvir's entreaties, and that's the way it should be. To my knowledge, to my limited knowledge, at least in the non-Hasidic world, there is unfortunately no kehillah where these rules are enforced, to my knowledge. Perhaps the Rabbanim feel it's simply not enforceable. They don't have the ability to enforce these regulations. And once you make an exception, then it becomes already a joke. This guy is an exception, so then why can't I be an exception? The unfortunate fact that since these rules cannot be enforced, there are many people who feel compelled to do better than the next guy, with all kinds of new, expensive trappings, whether they be in flowers or in decorations around the tables, that discuss the many, many piece bands and the many, many photographers and videographers, and not even discuss the opulent schmorg and meal, and unfortunately some bars, which people drink too much. It's a terrible thing. It is a simply terrible thing. I'm not discussing numbers. Numbers is a different story. Although the takanas, you would limit the numbers too. I can hear a person has many, many family members, shul members, whatever it may be. I think it should be a limit too, but there I can understand that a person has to feel it's chiyuvim, he has to find other people. But I have no understanding or sympathy for those who want to outshine everybody else. And what it creates is a vicious cycle. Other people who don't have the money feel compelled to match them, and they can chalila v'chas go into debt as a result of these symbols that they're making, and it leads them to chalila to dishonesty, as we know too well. So therefore, I believe that the rabbanim, even if they're unable to compel these standards, they should at the very least implore the balabatim to use restraint. I'm reminded of one of those tapes from yesteryear about, I think I kind of think it was Moskovich. How do you make a simcha? And there's a whole tune to the Nigun of Od Yeshem. And the last thing he says, well, you know, what kind of benches should you give? No, everybody should be given a full shas at the wedding. That's one of the last lines, you know. So yeah, it's a joke, but it's not a joke. I should add, once we're on the topic of these weddings, that the bands have run amok. They are so loud, they are literally dangerous. Eskidaka, they are dangerous. Up to 85 decibels is safe. Beyond that, it's already dangerous. They go up to well into the hundreds. And I try my best to tone it down. And I've told every chassan kallah they have to tone it down. And I was recently at a bar mitzvah. I simply left. I told the Baal Simcha, if it's not toned down, I'm just leaving. I left. It's dangerous. People have these earplugs. I don't find that they work too well. I very often now walk out for half the dance of the wedding because it's injurious. All part of the top the next guy syndrome, which is really unfortunate. You know, the Kriyaka writes famously in the pasuk Pnu Lachem Safona, that is a problem when people have a few dollars and they want to show how much they have, which causes all the problems when the non-Jews become jealous of us. And I add, that's true, but it causes problems when the Jews are jealous of us and want to copy us at these simchas, which are simply, it's just garish, it's ostentatious, it's over the top. Whatever we can do to try to limit the expenses at these events would be a great mitzvah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebbe. We appreciate it, especially Yasher Korach on our 70th conference call. Bezrat Hashem, we hope we can call upon you again in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.